Today is Friday, February 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden says the U.S. took steps to prevent civilian deaths during a Syrian raid that killed ISIS leader.
Because this is Islamic State leader, he was a top target for the United States. And the United States had been coordinating with the Syrian Democratic Forces, its allies, against Islamic State in Syria.
Russian President Vladimir Putin heads to China for talks amid tensions with the West over Ukraine.
Putin's talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping will be the first in-person meeting since they last met in 2019. The talks are expected to help to cement an already strong partnership between the two leaders.
And Africa is poised to improve COVID vaccination rates as supplies to the continent rises. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden says the United States took every possible precaution to minimize civilian casualties in a U.S. Special Forces counterterrorism raid in northwest Syria on Thursday that killed a major ISIS leader. He also says Abu Ibrahim al-Hashemi al-Qurashi chose to blow himself up in what he called, quote, a cowardly act, unquote. He says his administration will continue working with partners to keep up pressure on ISIS. Residents in the town of Atman near the Turkish border says helicopters landed and heavy gunfire and explosions were heard during the raid that began around midnight. They said U.S. forces used loudspeakers to warn women and children to leave the area. For more on the significance of the raid, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Barr.
Because this is Islamic State's leader, he was a top target for the United States. And the United States had been coordinating with the Syrian Democratic Forces, its allies, against Islamic State in Syria. And they had been following him for months now. This was definitely months in the making. The president had been informed about this potential raid in December. In fact, I was told that they did a tabletop exercise where they showed him the layout of the house. They knew there were civilians in this house, and they knew that they couldn't just strike this house with an airstrike because they wanted to minimize civilian casualties. So the president directed a raid to happen instead. And so when they arrived at this three-story house, they called out to the civilians in the house, trying to get them out. And they were able to help the family on the first floor get out, a man, a woman, and their four children, before a big explosion rocked the building. And as we now know, the explosion was from the ISIS leader himself. He bombed the third floor. The blast was so big that the Pentagon says it could not have been just a little suicide vest. Haji Abdullah's body was thrown from the building, as were some of the other people on the third floor. We know that from that blast, he was killed, his wife was killed, his children were killed.
From the Pentagon's perspective, how significant was this action?
This was significant. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby and U.S. Central Command Chief General Frank McKenzie said that he was a hands-on type of leader. He had been leading Islamic State since 2019. He was the leader during the Sasaka prison attack over the last week. He also was the leader while that deadly attack on Kabul airport occurred. I mean, this was the ISIS affiliate in Afghanistan, so he wasn't the direct head of that, but he is the ultimate leader of ISIS. So the responsibility does go back to him as well. So they say that that was very significant. And unlike al-Baghdadi, the leader who came before Haji Abdullah, while Baghdadi was iconic, General McKenzie says that this guy was much more into the day-to-day of the planning. He worked with couriers through his lieutenant to get out plans of attack. And so this is going to set Islamic State back, these officials say, because their main planner is now gone.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from Washington. The United Nations says any success against Islamic State is, quote, welcomed, unquote, following the U.S. raid that led to the death of ISIS leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashemi al-Qurashi. Deputy spokesman Farhan Haq, however, expressed concerns and reports of civilian casualties.
We've taken note of the announcement by the U.S. president of the death of Abu Ibrahim al-Qurashi, the leader of Daesh. We note with concern reports of civilian casualties. Daesh has committed heinous crimes and brought tragedy and death to thousands of men, women, and children. And we want to take this moment to remember the victims and families of terrorism and families of victims of terrorism everywhere in the world. And of course, as you know, the UN system as a whole has been very united in efforts to act against Daesh. So any successes against them are to be welcomed.
That's UN Deputy Spokesman Farhan Haq. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says Russia is still amassing troops in Belarus, which borders Ukraine.
The head of NATO has expressed concern about Russia's military buildup in Belarus, which borders Ukraine.
Over the last days, we have seen a significant movement of Russian military forces into Belarus.
Speaking at a news conference in Brussels, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg added that Russian troop numbers in Belarus are likely to climb to 30,000. He also praised the US commitment to NATO through its recent announcements that it will deploy more troops to Europe.
This is a powerful signal of US commitment and comes on top of other recent U.S. contributions to our shared security.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says the move is a necessary one in light of increasingly threatening behavior by Russia.
It is only prudent for us to take steps in the past several weeks to provide defensive security assistance to our Ukrainian partners.
More high-level diplomacy was expected in Moscow and Kiev amid deep uncertainty of Russia's intentions. I'm Karen Chamas.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. All eyes are on Russian President Vladimir Putin as he has amassed more than 100,000 Russian troops near the borders of Ukraine. Experts say Putin may have placed himself in a difficult position in an effort to elevate Moscow's standing in the world. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Russian President Vladimir Putin made his first comments in weeks Tuesday about Ukraine, blaming the U.S. and NATO for the mounting tensions.
Their most important goal is to contain Russia. That's the thing. In this sense, Ukraine itself is just a tool to achieve this goal. This can be done in different ways. One of them is to draw us into some armed conflict.
But experts note Putin is the one who deployed more than 100,000 Russian troops to Ukraine's border, Crimea, and Belarus to bolster his demand that NATO pull some of its forces out of Eastern Europe and promise to never admit Ukraine. With this military buildup, Putin has put himself into a box. Jeffrey Edmonds is a CNA research scientist.
He's made very maximalist demands. Assume that he knows we can't meet. We're not going to withdraw NATO infrastructure back to 1997 levels, which is one of the things that they've asked us to do. And so I think he's in a holding pattern waiting for the right military composition on Ukraine's border in order to actually take military action.
President Joe Biden says he and Putin understand each other, but Biden has also said he believes Putin is planning to invade Ukraine. Some experts say Putin wants to make sure Russia is still viewed as a major player on the world stage. Angela Stent is with the Brookings Institution.
And he believes that the rest of the world should treat Russia as if it were the Soviet Union. He doesn't want to restore the Soviet Union, but he wants to be treated as a great power whose views are respected and where people sort of fear Russia and they accept that Russia has a right to this sphere of influence in its neighborhood.
Some experts say Putin likely sees eastern Ukraine, where a war has been simmering since he annexed Crimea in 2014, as part of Russia. Michael Kimmage is with the German Marshall Fund of the United States.
So I think Putin might acknowledge that Western Ukraine is genuinely Ukrainian and perhaps belongs in the European cultural and political world. But in his eyes, Eastern Ukraine is sort of a version or an extension of Russia.
But what Putin really fears the most is dissent from his own people, says Bill Browder, founder of the Magnitsky Justice Campaign.
The average Russian is worse off, a lot worse off than when he first became president. And that's all, he owns that. That's all on him. And so he's pulling this strategy straight out of the dictator's playbook that when people are mad at you, make them mad at somebody else, start a war.
During his New Year address to the nation, Putin did not mention that he implemented a major crackdown on his critics. The most influential one, Alexei Navalny, was jailed 1 year ago after he survived a poisoning attack. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
U.S. lawmakers are nearing a deal on sanctions aimed at deterring Russian President Vladimir Putin from invading Ukraine. Several lawmakers who recently returned from a trip to Kyiv told VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson there is broad bipartisan unity on confronting Russia.
Some 127,000 Russian troops now massed along Ukraine's borders. as Russian President Vladimir Putin tells the world his demands, including a promise Ukraine will never join the NATO alliance, have not been met. U.S. lawmakers are now preparing a range of sanctions to deter conflict in Europe. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
There's certainly no interest in escalating this situation into any military conflict. We are hopeful this can be dealt with on a multilateral basis diplomatically. I think this is absolutely possible, and I'm hopeful that President Biden will be able to do that successfully.
Congressional Republicans have criticized the Biden administration for not moving quickly to deter Putin. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Sanctions after the incursion are less effective than sanctions before. And I hope the administration will bear that in mind as they move forward. They have a lot of latitude on their own.
But in a rare show of unity on Capitol Hill, lawmakers from both parties are moving forward on bipartisan sanctions legislation that would severely impact Putin's economic options. Republican Representative Mark Green.
He'd have to get his oil sold like Saddam Hussein sold his oil, you know, on the black market. I mean, that would be his only way to get oil out because he can't do a bank transaction. That's probably the most devastating of the sanctions. You know, anti-tank, anti-armor, lethal stuff, that's going to be video images that the Russian people are going to see. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to ask themselves, is that something they want?
Democrats want to reserve one of the most severe sanctions for use only if Putin goes into Ukraine. Democratic Representative Ami Bera.
Should Mr. Putin invade, you know, that Nord Stream 2 pipeline is not going to go through and, you know, probably never will come to completion. And that's going to have a huge economic impact on Russia. We will also probably implement, with broad bipartisan support, the biggest set of sanctions that we ever have. Now, none of us wants to do that because we understand that impacts the Russian people. But this is an elective choice that Mr. Putin is making.
Members of Congress who recently traveled to Ukraine and met with officials say American aid will arm the Ukrainians facing the Russian threat. They also found unity among America's allies. Democratic Representative Mickey Sherrill.
What struck me is, and I'm sure this is an unintended consequence of Putin's aggression, what struck me is the unity, that as we went to Brussels first and met with our EU counterparts and members of NATO leadership, how united we all were in standing against this type of aggression and in favor of a democratic nation fighting for freedom.
The United States has announced it will soon send 2,000 troops to Romania, Poland, and Germany. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is headed to Beijing to strengthen ties with China amid mounting Western pressure on Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Putin's talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping will be the first in-person meeting since they last met in 2019. The talks are expected to help to cement an already strong partnership between the two leaders. After talks with top officials, they will meet for lunch alone before attending the opening of the Winter Olympics. Putin told Chinese media he opposed attempts to politicize sport or to use it as a tool of coercion. The remarks were an apparent reference to U.S. diplomatic boycott of the Olympics. Experts say China and Russia have increasingly found common cause over what they believe is a U.S. disregard for their territorial and security concerns. I'm Karen Chamas.
Aid groups have condemned the militia group for killing at least 60 people at a camp for internally displaced people in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Norwegian Refugee Council, which supports the school in the region, says two of the school's students are among those killed. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi.
Authorities say fighters from the Kodeko militia group attacked residents of the Plain Savo camp in Ituri province with guns and machetes. Media reports say Kodeko initially came into contact with Congolese army soldiers near the camp Tuesday night, but changed direction and got past them to carry out its assault. The motive for the militia's attack is unknown. Tom P. Costa is the Norwegian Refugee Council Regional Advisor in West and Central Africa. He says attacks against civilians are on the rise, especially in the camps.
We've seen a new trend from armed group in attacking specifically and deliberately displacement camps. And this must not become a trend. This is why we have firmly condemned this act.
The NRC said another 68 people have been killed in five camps in the same vicinity since November. The armed group responsible for Tuesday's attack says it is fighting for land and resources in the country's east. The United Nations says the group's fighters have killed hundreds of civilians and forced thousands to flee from their homes in Ituri. Pei Costa says civilians need to be protected from those who want to harm them.
We are calling the Congolese government to better protect its civilians in this region. We also need the humanitarian community and the international community to do better in terms of protection and assistance. But we also need everyone to come back at the table of discussion. We need dialogues between these communities. Soldiers need to lay down their weapons. There is no place for violence right now in a country that is already facing the biggest humanitarian crisis in Africa.
The NRC said the 24,000 people living in the Savo camp are among the 1.7 million people displaced in Ituri province. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Africa appears poised to improve its vaccination rate as vaccine supplies to the continent have risen substantially. Last month alone, the World Health Organization reports 96 million doses were shipped to Africa. This is more than double the monthly deliveries of 6 months ago. From Geneva, Lisa Schlein has the story.
Africa appears poised to improve its vaccination rate as vaccine supplies to the continent have risen substantially. Last month alone, the World Health Organization reports 96 million doses were shipped to Africa. This is more than double the monthly deliveries of 6 months ago. Progress also can be seen in the declining rates of coronavirus cases and deaths for the third week in a row. Total COVID-19 cases in Africa now stand at nearly 11 million, including 239,000 deaths. However, WHO warns against complacency, noting an uptick in cases in South Africa and reports of a 25% increase in new weekly death trends in North Africa. The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says vaccination remains the best defense against severe illness and death from this dreaded disease. Despite the increased supplies, she says African countries still lag far behind the rest of the world in terms of actual vaccinations. She notes that only 11% of the African population is fully vaccinated and 85% have not received a single dose.
If African countries are to reach the 70% vaccine coverage target for their citizens by mid-year, they need to increase the pace of rollout sixfold. Currently, countries are vaccinating about 6 million people a week. It's the largest vaccination campaign in the continent's history, but it's not enough.
Late last year, fact-finding missions were conducted in African countries to understand the challenges and identify the bottlenecks bedeviling vaccination rollouts. Mohamed Omer Mukia Abu Zain is Africa's regional director of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. He says vaccine hesitancy is a big problem, especially in rural communities. To win the battle against COVID, he says it is important to gain people's trust.
When communities are in the driver's seat, they become vital contributors to finding solutions to the outbreaks of disease. Red Cross, Red Crescent teams across Africa have been at the front line of the response to COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic to build community trust and to address misinformation.
To meet the challenges ahead, WHO, the UN Children's Fund, and partners have launched an initiative designed to help 20 priority countries that have low vaccine uptake. Under the plan, support teams are being deployed to these countries. Their job is to help them meet the 70% vaccine coverage target by mid-year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Russia says it's shutting down German broadcaster Deutsche Welle's operations in Moscow and stripping its staff of their accreditation in a retaliatory move after Berlin banned Russian broadcaster RT in Germany. Moscow says it will stop the German channel being broadcast in Russia and starts proceedings that will see it declared a, quote, foreign agent, unquote, a designation that carries a negative Soviet-era connotation. The Russian Foreign Ministry also says it will bar entry to Russia for German officials involved in the move to ban RT. Deutsche Welle's director, Peter Lindbergh, says the move comes as a, quote, shock, unquote, and calls it, quote, an absolutely drastic overreaction on the part of the Russian side, unquote. Lindbergh says DW will keep on broadcasting until they receive an official notification. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Okwo in Washington. The World Bank and the Vatican are criticizing Lebanon's rulers for plundering the country's resources and abusing their positions of power. The World Bank recently reported that government revenues in Lebanon have collapsed by almost 50%, registering less than a 7% share of the country's GDP in 2021, one of the lowest ratios in the world after Somalia and Yemen. This, while a visiting Vatican envoy tells Lebanese leaders they, quote, must stop using Lebanon and the Middle East for foreign interests, unquote, ahead of talks for a planned papal visit. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
The World Bank has accused Lebanon's political rulers and the financial elite of orchestrating a deliberate depression by exploiting their grip on economic resources and threatening the country's long-term stability and social peace. It says meager amounts of foreign aid and the central bank's resources have been sapped. Meanwhile, the Lebanese currency has lost more than 90% of its value since 2019, plunging most Lebanese below the poverty line. Over 2 years into the financial crisis, Lebanon has yet to identify, least of all, embark upon a credible path toward economic and financial recovery, said Saroj Kumar Jaha, the World Bank's Near East Regional Director. The Vatican has also weighed in. Visiting Archbishop Paul Gallagher said that Pope Francis is very concerned and would like to visit Lebanon soon. Gallagher, the Vatican Secretary for Relations with States, criticized the country's elite, calling for an end to the few profiting off the suffering of many. The Lebanese people must be given the opportunity to be the architects for a better future in their land without undue interference, after meeting President Michel Aoun, a Christian ally to the Iran-backed Hezbollah. Joseph Bahut heads the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut. He tells VOA Lebanon's rulers are making the following proposal to the International Monetary Fund to secure a bailout. Of the $70 billion of losses Lebanon has incurred, 70% will be borne by the individual depositors. The banks will take 16%, and the state will bear the rest. The basic rule worldwide, Bahut says, is the state first takes responsibility, then the banks, and lastly, the depositors.
What's happening is not the result of certain accidents or economic misfortunes, but it is a deliberate act of leading the country to where it is. This is, I think, what the World Bank and the Vatican envoy are pointing out. Instead of trying to solve the crisis for the benefit of the majority, political and financial oligarchy is only taking care of its own interests at the expense of the people.
It's unclear how the International Monetary Fund would respond to this proposal as talks continue. But to date, politicians have struggled to implement several financial and accountability reforms the IMF requested months ago, including forensic audits of the central bank and state institutions, and a capital controls law. The World Bank reported that worryingly, key public and private actors continue to resist recognition of these losses, perpetuating the zombie-like state of the economy. Archbishop Gallagher offered the Vatican as a possible host for a dialogue between Lebanese political actors, if it is requested by all parties involved. But he also told President Aoun that any weakening of the Christian presence would destroy the internal balance and Lebanese identity. Gallagher says the Vatican's position was that reforms, along with the support of the international community, are necessary to help Lebanon preserve its own identity as an example of peaceful coexistence and brotherhood between different religions. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Many foreign journalists at the Beijing Winter Olympics tell VOA they have brought, quote, burner, unquote, devices such as phones and laptops completely wiped off personal data to protect their digital privacy. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, that's because China has a long record of surveilling and restricting journalists.
Reporters at the Beijing Olympics will not see much of Beijing at all. Instead, they'll be in a closed loop, taking official buses from venue to venue. COVID-19 policies aren't the only challenge. Another is digital privacy, and journalists are taking extraordinary steps to protect it. James Griffiths is Asia correspondent for the Globe and Mail, a Canadian newspaper. He is currently in the Beijing bubble.
I set up a burner computer, which is what we're talking on right now. I have a burner phone. I even have a burner iPad with me just to be doubly sure. So, you know, none of my usual identities are on that. Most of my accounts aren't logged into while I'm here.
Griffiths says it's difficult to find any reporter who is not using some type of burner device at the Olympic Games. It's a familiar routine for those reporting in China. This week, the Foreign Correspondents Club of China warned media freedom is declining at breakneck speed. Ahead of the games, the Committee to Protect Journalists warned reporters to assume everything they do online will be monitored. So far, those reporting from the Olympics bubble have reported no problems, even if they have limited mobility. Donna Spencer is a sports reporter for the Canadian press.
We can operate as reporters in the closed loop without restrictions, but the restrictions inherent in the closed loop prevent us from doing the kind of reporting that, you know, someone who is a foreign correspondent here would, you know, do year round.
It may not be ideal, but Australian journalist Eric Bagshaw says it's an acceptable trade-off.
Essentially, you're submitting yourself to such total surveillance that there's almost freedom in that. There's cameras absolutely everywhere, but you're not looking over your shoulder, wondering if you're being tailed because you're speaking to a Chinese dissident.
But even this kind of reporting has its challenges.
There's a tit-for-tat expulsion of journalists going on.
During our interview, Bagshaw was interrupted by authorities, reminding him of a required COVID test.
I just need to finish this video interview and then I'll come down. I'll be there in 10 minutes, if that's okay. Thank you very much. Bye. There you go. Right on it.
Just another challenge of reporting during a pandemic in China. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says the mission of the International Space Station will extend until 2030, but it is also planning to deorbit the ISS and send it plunging into Point Nemo in the South Pacific Oceanic Uninhabited Area in January 2031. Until then, the space agency says it will carry out plans to ensure that there is a smooth transition in operations to commercial services as outlined in its newly updated International Space Station Transition Report. In a press release, NASA says it has awarded Space Act agreements for the design of three free-flying commercial space stations that are being developed by U.S. industry. The commercial destinations are being set to begin operating sometime in the late 2020s and will run concurrently with the remaining time of the ISS mission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including a war of words picks up steam between top diplomats from the U.S. and Russia at the United Nations as the world waits to see whether Russia will invade Ukraine. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Achebe in Washington, wishing you a great weekend.
is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.